July 30th, 2017. You're listening to the Fancy Ramen Podcast. I'm Neil.
And I'm Scott.
And the music selection this episode is from the soundtrack of Uncanny Valley, released in 2015, composed by Danilo Capel. I apologize if I'm butchering that name. While the soundtrack is short, it masterfully sets a paranoid and unnerving theme for the game. More on that later, though. How's your week been, Scott?
It's been pretty good. In the realm of gaming, I haven't done too much new or interesting, but otherwise, I've stayed busy. I went to a farmer's market and had a really disappointing burrito. I mean, it's maybe not the greatest talking point, but it was really sad because at farmer's market, normally you expect to get something pretty good.
Yeah, I'm curious now. Was it not fresh enough, or was it just the selection of ingredients turned out to be
bad? It was both flavorless, and it had mushrooms in it, which I was surprised by because it's the single food I really refuse to eat almost any occasion. And it was $7 for a pretty normal size burrito too. And I mean, I don't think Omaha's farmer's market is anything super special, but I don't think I ever remember feeling as gypped about a purchase for food at any other farmer's market I've ever been to.
Have you ever gotten the... Oh, but actually, before I go there, what kind of burrito are we talking about? Like something that's fashioned off of a Chipotle burrito? Or something more along the lines of like a Whole Foods slash... Or a deli burrito, quote-unquote?
Oh, wait. Are you asking which one does this... which one is this more similar to? Because it was also a breakfast burrito, I should clarify.
Oh, that changes
as well.
Everything, actually.
Right, because breakfast burrito is easier, in my opinion. Like, wrapping a bunch of breakfast foods together is pretty much all you need to do to make a good breakfast burrito. Like, eggs, potatoes, some meat of your choice, salsa's nice, and then a little bit of, like, spices or seasoning on the eggs or one of the other ingredients. And I think you're golden for the most part. I also like onions in mine a lot, but this was like, it was like eggs and some assorted vegetables that were it was definitely on like a, what do you call just a flat cooktop? It was one of those portable grills more or less. And it was some fajita style vegetables, though I think there weren't onions in it, and there were mushrooms in it, so I was surprised by the assortment of vegetables in it, and just disappointed because it had like no flavor, and it had mushrooms tucked away secretly that also upset me.
I think that's one of the problems with a lot of healthy food is that they forget, like, salt is not necessarily good in high quantities, but you can't cook food without using some salt.
You also can't detect flavor very easily without some salt. Like it's almost a necessity to boost our like sensory intake of foods. I would also say that I'm a very consistent under-salter when it comes to making my own food. I almost always go under on salt and over on black pepper because those are my preferences. But I normally don't avoid using salt at all. Like if I won't use salt if my ingredients have salt at some point in time in them. But if there's no salt in any ingredient whatsoever, then I normally add just like a sprinkle. And I'm talking just maybe a pinch, but even that does a world of difference. And it felt like it was lacking on salt. It was lacking on any other seasonings you could have used. And I didn't get salsa with it either. I honestly don't need to have a like 10-minute long burrito tirade, but it was the first time I've made a purchase at a farmer's market that left me disappointed when it came to food. And I was surprised that was something I was going to have to come to terms with in my life.
Well, I hear you've also been extremely disappointed in Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild.
No, actually, I finally got my hands on it. I've been playing it a bit. And I don't really think it's much of a spoiler to say that I made it to one of the four... It's a guardian beast. Is that what it's called?
Yes, I believe so.
Yeah, it's one of the four... I guess it's one of the four cardinal directions and four giant enemies that are optional but very recommended by the game to tackle and conquer before you go to fight Calamity Ganon. And so I fought it. It was a fun fight. And I also liked that after the initial fight to just board it, I got to do some puzzles with it on the inside before finishing the quest. I was surprised that it's kind of like a very skimpy dungeon in that sense. But I think that's most of Breath of the Wild's challenges and dungeons and puzzles, is that there's a lot more of them and they're a lot more spread out. Not always less intricate, but definitely less time involved on a lot of the puzzles, which is kind of nice. I do have to say, like, you get to really mix up the gameplay elements from combat and exploration and puzzle solving frequently enough that I don't ever think you get bored or stuck in a rut on one type of gameplay that you're doing.
So I'm curious, because I'm eventually going to be getting back to this game. Are there no dungeons whatsoever in that game that have the traditional Zelda length?
I don't think so. I haven't encountered any, at least, which I'd say that there are some things that are kind of cool. Like, there are challenges that almost feel dungeon-like in how long they take. Divine Beast. Maybe that's what it's called, is a Divine Beast. In order to even get to the Divine Beast that I conquered, I had to, like, pretty much fight my way up a path. And I know it's all combat. It's not necessarily puzzle solving. But just going up that path, because of the environmental constraints that I couldn't climb anywhere, I had to follow sort of a set route. There were a couple of different deviations I could make along the path, but for the most part, it was pretty linear. And that was a pretty good slog. I remember I booted the game and probably did that part for 3 gameplay sessions, which were probably all underneath an hour before I was able to make it to the Zora's domain. And so I really liked that. Like, it did feel kind of like the dungeon length I'd expect out of a Zelda game, even if it was just a challenge, you know, progressing forward on the path. But I'd say that there are challenges or things that you are going to deal with in the game, judging by pretty much this alone, that will reach that same level of time involvement. Though, as far as puzzles go, I don't know. The puzzles all seem to be short and sweet. Even if you have a really hard time solving a puzzle, I still don't think it's going to take, you know, even a quarter as long as a dungeon normally would in those games.
The thought occurred to me that maybe aside from the Elder Scroll games, and by extension Fallout 3, 4, and New Vegas, I don't think open world games have ever really done dungeons. And if I include the requirement done dungeons well, then I would arguably take Fallout and Elder Scrolls out of those categories. But I don't necessarily know what they're not doing correctly or in a way that would allow me to enjoy those more. It's just that the experience I get from dungeons and other games usually is more rewarding than the Elder Scrolls. But I don't want to go on that tirade, but I guess I kind of had the expectation that Zelda would bring that into fruition.
It's interesting. I feel like it might be a handicap that happens to all open world games. If you want to make a good world, you're going to have to spend most of your time focusing on that map design and all of that work with making your overworld really fun and work cohesively with itself while still having, you know, unique and individual parts that make exploring valuable or worthwhile to the player. Meanwhile, with all of the other older Zelda iterations, even though this is really a throwback or kind of a spiritual successor to the idea of all the exploration in the very first Legend of Zelda, the big difference is traversing the overworld in that game, while it took a while, it still wasn't nearly as involved as crawling in the dungeons in that game. And so, And also because the technology limitations too, there's really not that much that you could have done to make the overworld more complex than they already did. While the dungeons, by adding locked doors and keys like that, they were, and the puzzles that you'd need to solve to access those areas, they did a good enough job of, you know, still really having a lot of the gameplay elements be focused on the dungeoneering in those games. And Breath of the Wild, I think maybe it's too hard to make four main dungeons in addition to the shrines, in addition to all of the things going on in the overworld and all of the kind of open-ended quests that also were sort of a thing in the old games, at least in some of the more recent games from probably the N64 forward. There were definitely side quests, though they were pretty few and far between, and they were minimal enough that it felt like you wanted to complete all of them to get all of the necessary benefits or items or whatnot, even though some of them were easy enough to skip without losing any real game story content or absolutely necessary items. In this game, it's pretty much you can take anything that you want to do and you can do it, and if you don't feel like it, you can just leave it be to either add or reduce the challenge for the game later on. And so, I don't know, by having that reduction in dungeons, there's a lot more options available to the player. But yeah, there isn't that really good like long-term puzzle solving where we have a very complex problem to solve and I've got to go through 20 rooms in like a really wide or vertical structure that changes its dimensions or shape as I progress through it, or as I unlock new parts of it and get a better understanding of the layout.
True.
Like
yeah.
The architecture is missing. A lot of the architecture is missing. And I don't think that's bad. I like the change because there are some awesome dungeons and Zelda's done so many. Maybe that's the other thing, is I don't feel like I've done dungeons before, and I'm sure you've played Zelda games in which a dungeon feels somewhat similar to another dungeon that they had done previously. Maybe a couple titles back, or maybe, you know, in the previous game there was something similar. And so at least they're not trying to capitalize on the nostalgia of puzzles they've already made, and by condensing things down into the smaller shrine puzzles, they're really not going to have to worry about coming up with anything too elaborate or too complex that may be a big winner or a bust, depending on how people feel about it. Because if a shrine sucks, you can be done with it, or you can just, you can either finish it and whine about how hard it was, or you can just decide to ignore it too, which is also totally fine with this game.
Right, you get to avoid the Water Temple conundrum.
Exactly. And I mean, I've never solved the Water Temple ever. So I understand how some people might skip that.
Along with that, what else have you been playing?
I've also been playing Persona 5 as well. I'm trying to catch up on all the stuff you guys got done months ago. Not even to mention the stuff that I still have on retainer. Like, I'm probably a third of the way through Dishonored 2. And I'm trying to get back to that, but I wanted to knock out Persona 5 first, and Breath of the Wild's just in kind of some small blips of free time that I don't feel like sitting down and playing either of the other games I have set up. But for Persona 5, I won't say too much, except that this is the furthest I've ever gotten in a Persona game in general, but I'm just absolutely loving the story. I'm along for the ride. Like, I can't say anything that I find lacking about it or disappointing. I'm kind of white knuckled with suspense at certain times, and I have the gameplay to an easy enough point where I'm not worrying about the dungeon crawling and, you know, grinding against enemies and whatnot. I'm just playing it at a very comfortable pace, and I think I'm close to done because I've got 80 hours in, and I just got to say it's one of the best stories I've really experienced in a video game in a long time. I've loved all the twists and turns, and it's been like really emotionally fulfilling for playing a video game like this too. I totally understand how you were saying when you played it, it feels like it's literally made for current events and what's going on, and like just the kind of cultural and social zeitgeist of what we're experiencing here in the United States in some ways, which is really crazy for a game that was, you know, in development for several years ahead of time in a completely different country. Like, it's really cool to see kind of the overlaps and feel like a game's really speaking to you when you're not. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm the immediate target audience. I just happen to be.
We're definitely not, and yet somehow it still speaks to you. It speaks to
exactly.
us.
I'm not the target audience, and yet I feel like it's crafted just for me in certain ways. And so that's really cool. It's just a great game. I'm excited to maybe give final thoughts and feelings quickly when I do finish it. If anybody's like on the fence and they already own a PS4, man, it's worth checking out. Like, it's really cool. And the JRPG grinding is so manageable. I don't think I've had to deal with a palace after maybe the first time, or maybe is the second one, in having to go back, like, and being underprepared or anything. Like, I never feel like I'm absolutely just on this tightrope of not having enough SP or HP or items to progress forward. I always feel like if I want to continue forward, I can. I might have to like grit my teeth a little bit, but that's it. I don't feel pressured to spend a bunch of time in mementos either, like grinding and fusing personas. Like, if you play on the easier modes, it's really easy to get by and the story's super engrossing, and I feel like the time just flies when you play it.
I'm excited for when you finish the game so we can kind of go over it one last time.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear our spoiler cast for it too. I'm looking forward to finding out everything that, you know, gets talked about, because there's a lot of things that I guess I want to know that I feel will probably come up in your discussion. But that's about all I've got for games. I know you were trying to finish Uncanny Valley, and there might be another game you're interested
in. Yeah, I definitely wanted to finalize my thoughts and feelings on Uncanny Valley since I actually finished that this morning. I also wanted to draw some recognition to the music, because as I referred to earlier, I think the soundtrack is probably one of the strongest points of the game, despite it being, I'm guessing it's probably less than 20 minutes long. But Uncanny Valley, as I've alluded to before, is kind of this weird survival horror game that also has like time management involved. But unlike, I'm trying to think of other games that play very importantly with time or days.
Majora's Mask is about the only game I know that time's like a really big deal. And even then, it's slow time, so you can get enough done within the day and watch the clock for events.
Okay, so I have an example that doesn't necessarily fit exactly, but it's an example of a game that does it well, and that would be Papers, Please. You are pressed for the actions that you need to do, or at least it's like it doesn't require you to do them. But
you feel compelled to get things done as fast as possible, and you feel pressure by not optimally using your time.
Exactly. Like you have feedback at the end of the day, basically by how many people or how many people you process and how many people you can detain. Whereas in Uncanny Valley, when the game gives you these nights, which again are dictated by like no specific time indication aside from 6 units of time that then have 66 seconds each, which you don't necessarily know if these are hours, although you could assume that's the case. But the game really doesn't have any feedback as to whether or not you're doing the job right.
I thought there was a grumpy guard that's supposed to tell you you're doing everything wrong when you start.
Yeah, and the guard says that no matter what you do. So really, you don't have feedback on if you're actually checking all of the rooms correctly. And I guess I could understand why, because that technically doesn't matter. So I'm going to get lightly into the spoilers, but that timed duration of the game really is only the first part, and then it becomes something which there's no time limit. But the game does such a poor job, I feel, of actually dictating those parts and what triggers them that, I don't know, it forces you to get into this weird mindset where you are timed on all of your actions, yet you find these cassette tapes that you want to play to get more of the story. The issue is that the cassette tapes can sometimes be more than a minute long, and that eats up your time to actually go and explore.
but it doesn't eat up your infinite time that I assume happens probably when you're experiencing like a nightmare or something.
Well, yes and no. Like, so in the nightmares, you don't have access to the cassette player and the tapes.
Gotcha. So you do have to burn an hour to just listen to the cassette tapes and games. So
exactly.
A sixth of your time is gone if you actually want to hear the story.
And so that's the interesting dilemma here, is that the cassettes lead you down a specific set of clues and theories. So like, you could be theory crafting as you're going through these. I think it's actually only 5 or 6 days total that you actually have time to do these things. But if you were smart, so to speak, in your time management, you would do it during the period of the game that is no longer dictated by time. But the only way to get to that period of time or that point in the game, you already most likely have the reveal that beats the surprise that the tapes would give you, or the, you know, beats what the tapes would help you theory craft.
So you just get confirmation after the fact.
Exactly. And that seems like the biggest lit down of the game storytelling. It seems very flawed to me.
Have you encountered that before in a game, though, where you've read a note that's just further solidified what you've been thinking, or something that's suggested earlier in the game? I mean, it could be something that's super obvious that becomes apparent, and it's a reaffirmation of that, or something that you just kind of suspect, and then you find something later that says, oh, okay, that explains this phenomena that I was thinking about earlier.
When it was meant to be like a big plot twist?
Well, I don't even know if it's a big plot twist, but I'm trying to rack my brain real quick to think of anything where, because normally when it happens for me is it's a game like I'm exploring and I find a note and it explains something that I didn't understand, and I could have found the note earlier, but I was just dumb and missed it, or just took an alternative route that kept me from having more context about an event that happened, and so I do it incorrectly out of order, or at least out of order with what the developer expects.
So maybe the best way to put it is, let's pretend that The Sixth Sense is actually a video game, like an adventure game. And Bruce
gotcha.
Willis, who, spoilers if you haven't seen The Sixth Sense, Bruce Willis is dead the whole time, and the kid talks to him because he sees dead people. But so imagine you're playing this game, and for whatever reason, you suddenly see that Bruce Willis has a bunch of stab marks on his back at the start of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And just, he retains them the whole time. Like, that's kind of how it felt to me. That you learn, and not to mention, too, that maybe even the title of the game gives too much away, because, spoilers, one of the characters is a robot. And Uncanny Valley...
Okay.
I don't know what the developers were thinking, because there's not really a good twist in the game because of this issue. Or at least the only twist I can think of is realizing that the facility you're at was a facility making robots, and that one of the characters you encounter is a robot that looks an awfully lot like a human. So,
oh, that's a really, like, I don't know, disappointing but cheeky twist for the naming.
And so maybe that'd be fine if they let you actually listen to the tapes without consuming important time. That is also pretty important in getting one of the better endings. But I guess that's also partly what makes the game replayable.
Yeah.
I really wanted to like this game, and I really want this game to serve as maybe like a stepping stone for the developers, because I think there's a lot of really cool ideas and a lot of great ways that this idea could have been executed. And there are a lot of great assets, like the pixel art. I mean, it's whatever. It's good for what it is. And I think they accomplish what they're looking to do with it. And I think the soundtrack is actually spectacular. That is half of the reason why the game is scary at all. The soundtrack and the sound design. Ultimately, I feel like I could have just not played it and been better off too.
And by better off, do you mean just never having any sort of conclusion with the game, or better off as in I'm going to watch a Let's Play and or look at a channel that shows all of the endings or possible paths?
Well, so I actually did that to see some of the other endings, because the game isn't necessarily that fun to play. So once I got a few endings, I felt completely justified in just going out and seeing what else the game had to offer.
Yeah.
And partly because I started playing a new game available on Steam called The Letter. I feel like I'm doing a disservice to it by saying it's a visual novel. But it is. It is a visual novel, but it's a scary or horror-based visual novel about a curse. What made me really interested from the get-go was when I saw screenshots that had relationship bars like Until Dawn. And then one of the feature lines, or not catchphrase, but one of the important tidbits you get from the trailer is that you actually control 7 different characters through the duration of this game. So I won't necessarily go into details here, but I will say that the story seems pretty interesting. The writing, especially the grammar, at times leaves a bit to be desired, and I kind of feel like there may be a couple plot holes here and there. I'm assuming those will actually get tied up as I get further into the game. But as a whole, when I play The Letter, what I see and feel is a lot of inspiration that's well-directed, and I guess just like a cohesiveness between the game design and the game's media, if that makes sense. And that's something that maybe Uncanny Valley lacks a bit in. And maybe it's unfair to compare like 16-bit styled retro adventure game to a visual novel. But there are actually some other mechanics that come into play with The Letter, like QTEs that kind of spice up things. And it also gives you the ability to actually go in and see the story branch between each of the chapters. So you can see like, oh, I missed a branch here and I'm not sure what I could have done, but maybe if I chose something else, I could have gotten this part of the branch. It's like a game embracing the system or the genre that it's in, much like how you can do that in Life is Strange. Granted, this is probably something that's been done in like dating sims and other foreign visual novels, but
where you get to see the branch point where, yeah. Oh, this is where you made a critical decision and the game will change drastically because of it.
And not just see it as in you see it in the writing, if you will, like where someone asks completely unrelated to the actual story, but do you want to go here? Or like, do you want to go out to eat or do you want to eat at home? And then you're right. Well,
especially if it warns you, I should think about this because it's a very important decision.
Right. So it'll have those points too, but also you can literally click a story branch, or I can't recall what they actually label it as, in the game's UI to actually access a map that shows you the branching paths in your story. I just got through my first POV, or the first chapter of 7, and I have already started to appreciate at the start of the second chapter, I'm maybe midway through, how the different POVs give you light on the different characters, their feelings, their motivations, in a way that you definitely don't see from the other protagonists. And so like I really, really do appreciate the writing that they've done to make each character personable, especially given that in my first chapter, I couldn't stand a few of the characters, and immediately after in the second chapter, those characters have become endearing to me.
So I'd like to hear your opinion. I don't know if you've looked at, say, any of the review scores that this has received, but are you aware of its overwhelmingly negative critical reception?
Oh, seriously?
So if you go to the Wikipedia real quick, it's got both the collection of aggregate scores and review scores, and we've got Nintendo Life giving it a 1 out of 10 stars. Nintendo
wow.
World Report gives it a 2 out of 10. Cubed 3 gives it 0 out of 10. Hardcore Gamer 1 out of 5. Pure Nintendo 4.5 out of 10.
Oh, wait, and then there's one scores. Issue that may come into play, that there are two games named The Letter.
Okay.
The one on Nintendo, I think, is some really shitty horror game. It's on the Wii, right?
Yes, on the Wii U. So I have the letter game then.
But actually I had the same issue when I was trying to look up The Letter. I kept finding I was trying to see what platforms it was on. And I don't know if I mentioned it, but I'm playing this on Steam, and I'll shoot you a link to it real quick actually. But
oh, actually, okay, I've seen a video of this then. So I probably am looking at something else, because in Steam at least it's got very positive reviews.
And only 56 reviews so far too, so I'm assuming that it's not a relatively well-known game. It's not without its faults. Maybe one of the biggest issues I've had, and this probably comes in mind with the fact that while it's an indie game, it seems like there's probably a decent number of people doing the visual designs. So character
artwork...
Right,
because it does look good.
Yeah, character artwork varies. So based on the full portraits that you see when you're talking to the character, they are not your POV, if you will. It looks very fluid, and there's a slight movement to it. I think... I can't remember the technology, but I think it uses something called Live 2D. I could be wrong. Maybe it's like just some sort of weird flash variant, but it uses Live 2D, which essentially allows you to use a bunch of 2D or, you know, picture elements or assets and make them more fluid and full of with motion to give it more a sense of like life, right?
I see. Okay.
That style has this very distinct soft look to it. And I say soft when I'm talking about the edges of the characters, like the outlines and whatnot. And then when you get to the portrait art that they use, for your menus, mm-hmm. as well as your text dialogue portrait, which is, you know, when you don't have a character on screen, those are much more sharper and defined and have a much stronger pencil, like pencil and ink appearance to them, as opposed to the softer pastel look of the full body portraits. So that's kind of maybe like, yeah, it's kind of a weird disconnect for me that I don't necessarily think should give anyone a negative impression of the game. It's just something that bothers me a bit. The opening video, I guess you could say it's kind of like your hype video, just like how a lot of Japanese RPGs have the animated sequence at the start of their game, which shows off all the characters and a bunch of action shots, which may or may not actually happen in the game storyline. The letter has one as well, and it's very anime. Like, it's completely different from the other two art styles that the game features. And I also would almost even argue that, like, after seeing that opening, I kind of felt like I knew exactly what the rest of the story is going to be. I haven't gotten far enough to know what the curse is, so to speak. But I felt like maybe I kind of wish that opening was skippable or didn't play. Because, I don't know, it almost feels like I already know Darth Vader is Luke's dad in episode 4. But yeah, so far, I think it's really, really good. I really don't have any negative feelings, negative overwhelming feelings about the game so far, aside from the grammar and that weird, like the weird art jump styles.
So quick question, looking at the branch tree options, I can see that there's obviously chapter marks, and then there's butterflies, it looks like, which are one of the two available paths on at least this sample map.
Yeah.
And so I also see an exclamation point, and then it's kind of an offshoot from the linear progression. Do you know what that is or what that does? Is that an event that unlocks a completely different
option? I think the exclamation mark, if I'm imagining the branch tree in the same way, the exclamation mark is a QTE that would otherwise end in a premature bad ending. So like there are bad endings. Because as Tiffany and I were playing the first girl's POV, we got the good ending naturally, but we decided to go back and see what would have happened on the other endings, and they were real bad, like real, real bad. So that exclamation mark, though, is not necessarily a bad ending, but just a game over.
Like
where something happens that obviously the game developers did not want you to actually go down that route or go down that specific failure. Mm-hmm. Because in doing so, that doesn't allow the rest of the story to go together. So it's like there's a path that you're going to go. You just have to not suck at QTEs. Which, by the way, if you hate QTEs, you can also just disable them, which that's great.
Oh, that's nice.
It also maybe holds the title of having the earliest jump scare. So like there are jump scares. Just want to say that because like I personally hate jump scares, but I'm not really bothered. I mean, I'm bothered by them. Like I am affected by these jump scares. not in the same way that I hate a game like Five Nights at Freddy's, because that game is only about jump scares. This game actually has content to it, you know? The jump scare happens literally on the first screen of the game. So, like, as soon as you hit the start button, a shadow starts creeping up. And even though you know it's coming, it still causes me to kind of yell a bit.
That's actually really funny to think about. Like, they're going to go ahead and get it out of the way and get you ready for the impending horror and tension that the rest of the game is going to have.
Yeah, I do want to add the music is also really pretty good so far. Like, when I don't talk about a game's music, it's almost safe to assume that the music is, like, it's fine, it's okay. But when I say a game has good music, it's like, I'm really appreciating the tracks. It seems a little bare right now in terms of the number of unique tracks so far, but I'm also only through 1/7 of the game, assumedly. So I can't speak too much past that at this point. Should we check what's in the hot pot?
Yeah, let's go ahead and lift the lid.
So amidst the pre-order hunt for the SNES Classic, ThinkGeek briefly had a surprise stock of NES Classics on July 25th with a slight catch. The discontinued stock was only being sold with other products, or other Nintendo products, including puzzles, models, and some more extravagant pieces of Nintendo property. Bundles started at $140, more than double the console's original price, with the more expensive bundles going for above $200. So here's the context. ThinkGeek's parent company is GameStop, which is the probable explanation as to how they received this, like, final batch. My question, is it scumbaggy to hide their high prices behind additional, potentially unwanted and poorly selling merchandise?
So it seems to me as though you answer your question with the way that you ask it.
Maybe.
I kind of have to agree, though. Like, if I want that product, I might find it pretty annoying to have to buy a price-hiked bundle with a bunch of things that I don't want. Like, the Humble Bundle is nice when there's a bunch of indie games that I don't want and one that I do, because normally the one I get is still at a pretty good discounted price. So it's like, if I'm going to spend, let's say, because these originally retailed for $80 or $60?
I believe it was $59.99.
Okay, so yeah, it was $60. I'm confusing it with the new SNES coming out. So it's more than double the price, and I don't really care what's in it if it's not, you know, more NES games. There's nothing there that is going to necessarily cater to the initial interest for the NES in the first place, right? Like, if you're not getting more games out of it, which is oftentimes the nicest thing about getting a bundle with a console, is to get more games or some pretty, like, essential hardware, I guess. When the Xbox One was selling with the Kinect, for instance, if you really wanted a Kinect and you felt like it was integral to the machine, like, it made sense to have that in the bundle if that's how you felt. But for Xbox to, say, sell an Xbox One, and instead of a Kinect, you get a Master Chief plushie, even though, you know, really all you wanted to do was buy Viva Pinata and a couple other games. Though, that's Xbox 360. It's been a real long time since I've had
Xbox.
Yeah,
you know what? You want to play Quantum Break. Who cares about
exactly.
Halo?
Yeah, exactly. You want to play Quantum Break. But, I mean, at least if you get a good bundle, you're getting Quantum Break or Halo 5 or something, as opposed to the Quantum Break limited edition poster or right. other shit like that. Like, and it seems like you're paying a lot for the item if you're paying, say, double or more than that, and you're still really only getting the base goods that you were interested in the product for in the beginning, and then some, like, consolation prize stuff that you're paying a lot more for than you probably should.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
It's scumbaggy. What are you supposed to do, though, when it's maybe the last available option for this, right? And that's the other thing that's kind of scumbaggy about it as well. And instead of trying to move the stock at the value it's obviously worth, or that it originally retailed for, you tag on a bunch of other things that you need to get out of your inventory and hike the price up to unload a bunch of shit that you don't already want to have in your inventory. It seems like somebody in marketing thought, like, this is going to be a great idea. And any one of those that they sold, I feel bad, at least for the fact that unless you really wanted that stuff, it kind of seems like you got extorted to buy a bunch of crap at a higher price to get the item that you really wanted.
And obviously there's fault that lies with Nintendo too, making things so hard to get.
Yeah. I mean, I think we all agree on that, and Cookie's been extremely vocal about, you know, Nintendo only producing 50, or I don't remember what his last number was. Maybe it was 10, or maybe he even said 5 NES Classic consoles. That's right. Like, they knew it was going to be a very high demand product, and it became very hard to get a hold of for the individuals who wanted to get it.
I wanted to follow up on the At Games Sega Genesis flashback. Basically, look before you buy it. There's a lot of issues. And before I get started on this, I want to give credit to where it's due. GameSpot's Peter Brown wrote a very, very detailed article about some of these issues, and you can find it on GameSpot.com. But to start with, the wireless controllers require AA's. They're also not rechargeable, so that means if you use the wireless controllers, you will be, just like the old days of Xbox, swapping out AA's.
Back to the old days of sucking down batteries every couple of days.
It reportedly feels like frame skip is enabled, which is maybe a feature you're familiar with emulators.
Yeah, I'm aware of frame skip and some of the issues it can bring to emulation.
And for more intensive games like Sonic, for that matter, one of the titles that you would highly value on the Sega Genesis flashback, the emulation suffers as a whole because of it. Yeah, just a quick PSA there. Didn't really want to go too much further into the At Game Sega Genesis flashback, but its reputation seems justifiably poor.
Yeah, while we're following on the emulation topics, there's the Breath of the Wild multiplayer mod. So have you looked at this at all?
Yeah, I have a little bit. So basically, this group called Funi is using the Wii U version and the emulator Cemu. I could be wrong with that pronunciation, but I'm assuming it's Cemu, C-E-M-U. And essentially, like, because when I first read this headline, I was thinking, like, how the hell do you connect two Switches together? But okay, using emulation makes a whole lot more sense. And I also want to note too, last I checked, there's not a working public patch. They only have proof of concept screenshots. Excuse me. But more or less, it seems like in its complete form, you would have complete cooperative interaction between characters, or between Links, I guess. It even had a screenshot of one Link trying to go up and ride another Link's horse, and it has the message displayed, something like, you can now ride this. I'll have to pull
you
it up again.
You can't ride player one's horse.
Yeah, there we go. What concerns me most, though, and maybe by the fact of me putting this on a podcast doesn't help at all, but I'm really wondering why this is even public knowledge at this point and this early in the project, because
you want to dodge that cease and desist as best as possible.
And I'm just really, really curious, because I understand that the Legend of Zelda and Link's journey in each of these games is truly meant to be a solitary journey, right? Like, that's a lot of the appeal. But immediately then you remember the Four Swords.
Yeah, Four Swords for the GameCube, that was the whole thing that they sold it on, was Link teamwork. And if there's ever a sandbox that would be great for teamwork with another player, all of the, you know, fun physics and open world to deal with in Breath of the Wild, it is a perfect opportunity if they're able to do a good job with it.
Right. What's another open world game that was previously single player that turned out to be, I mean, not saying my personal opinion on the matter, but turned out to be a huge, giant success? Grand Theft Auto.
I mean, before becoming a victim of overwhelmingly negative feedback,
That's true. That's
there was a rise before the fall.
Grand Theft Auto Online at this point has overshadowed Grand Theft Auto 5.
It sounds like it. I'm not a big Grand Theft Auto player myself. I don't know for certain, but it sure does seem that way. The most that I see, at least referencing the game for GIFs or videos or things like that, are almost always relevant to multiplayer. So I assume from that and what I see that there are more people who spend time on multiplayer. And I can see how it'd be a lot of fun to do that with other players interacting with your world.
It's funny, too, because one common thread between these two games, or that could be, I guess, when you look at GTA Online's, whatever, their subreddit and so forth, one of the most popular things to come up are the crazy stunts that people do using the game's physics, involving things like ramping up a car into the air, having a plane come down and get underneath the car and carry it far enough.
Exactly, and we see similar things in Breath of the Wild as well, with people playing around with all the different things that you can do with the Sheikah Slate and the stasis or the magnet to make a mine cart or a flying fortress, you know?
Yeah, can you not imagine what kind of amazing things you could do with multiple people using the Sheikah Slates at once?
Oh, it'd be so cool. The fact that you could use stasis on two objects at once could be amazing. You could have boulder jousting. There's a lot of really great ideas that are coming to mind just instantly thinking about the options available. You could build a bridge. Holy shit, you could build a bridge easy enough. You could put you could use the Cryonis, I think is what it is, or the Cryos ability down in a body of water or like a swamp, because it'll work in that toxic sludge as well. And then you could have someone move a tree branch on top of it or shift it over. Like, you'd have enough to actually build a strut for a pretty large bridge. There's all sorts of things you could do. It's really cool. What if you grip a magnetic surface or you stand on top of a metal box and then someone carries you and lifts you up to a new area or is able to swing you around with momentum? Like, there's so many cool things you could imagine doing, and that's just with the implementation of using the Sheikah Slate and not a bunch of other things like the items that you'd have available. So it could be super cool. I hope it works out. I hope that they don't get absolutely destroyed while they're still trying to develop this with involvement from Nintendo and maybe Nintendo's legal team. It could be really cool to see. I'd love to see what it ultimately becomes as far as the available options to players, the amount of people who can interact in a game. I don't know if they'll limit it to 2 or 4, or maybe you can put 32 links in a game. Who knows?
Oh, that would be
it'd be a shit show, but it'd be amazing.
I'm prone to have no expectations for it just because I think if it does start to get off the ground, that Nintendo would immediately say, nah.
Right. It's not something to get your hopes up for, but just to keep in the back of your mind to at least pay attention to.
And if Nintendo is listening, please just do this. Just make it.
Yeah, do the right thing. Just team up with the people who are emulating your game.
Oh, and speaking of copyright infringement with games, this isn't on the docket, but did you see there's a Mega Man maker?
No, I haven't seen that, but I can imagine what game it may be violating a copyright with.
The only reason I think it's interesting is that Capcom has, in the past, teamed up with these sort of fan projects. That's how Mega Man X Street Fighter, I think it was, happened to come to be. If anyone's going to team up with anyone, who knows? We might actually see Mega Maker, is the actual title, I guess, become something official.
I don't play Mega Man games, but I'd love to still watch people play fan-created Mega Man levels.
What else do we got here?
I just had the hype train for the end of the episode with the Long Dark Sandbox and Story Mode release happening in 2 days.
Wait, so the Long Dark is releasing in 2 days?
That's correct.
Wow, it's August already.
I know. It's July 30th now, and August 1st is not tomorrow, but the day after.
So I have no doubt that you are full of information regarding this release, but I had one question before you began.
Okay.
Are they introducing moose?
No moose. Sadly, no moose at all. But they are bringing in Aurora. And I'll actually talk about that. I'll get into it if you're cool with that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hinterland Studios has confirmed with the Aurora, which they've teased before in previous trailers, and I think they've talked about a little bit on their Twitter, that the Aurora will be available in both the sandbox and the story modes on the August 1st release and the subsequent update to unlock chapters 1 and 2. So they haven't explained it in very much detail, and the information that I have is Raphael von Lierop, who's he does most of the, I think he's one of the head developers, and he also does a lot of the public outreach with Twitter as well. He said in a tweet, quote, "Since a lot of people in the community seem to be wondering about this, colon, yes, all caps, the Aurora will be in survival mode at launch." And so we only know a couple basic things about the Aurora. A, it will probably be pretty pretty, and it will also light up the outdoors at night. We don't know if it's going to light up the interior of structures, which has been a big issue with this game, is it always seems much too dark inside buildings than you would actually expect from natural lighting or moonlight. And then the other thing with the Aurora is that it should have an effect upon electronics. And so we've seen it in little videos or trailers interact with light bulbs and radios, but we don't know much more about it. And in addition to this, the game does follow the premise that there is a geomagnetic event that has messed with both the wildlife and the weather. And so we don't know if this geomagnetic aurora event will also affect animal behavior. But I'm keeping kind of my eyes and ears open to see if there's anything about that, because that could be an interesting change as well if they do anything with it. Additionally, a gripe that's available, I think, to some people is that the Mystery Lake area, which is one of the starting areas, it's probably the easiest for the sandbox mode, is going to be undergoing changes with this update. And so the developers warned that save files, items, and even full sandbox lives could be lost with the release of this story mode if people have items or their characters in the Mystery Lake area. And they didn't really make it clear if it was in certain locations that they listed on a tweet, or if it really meant the area in whole, because they pretty much stated for all of the structures that exist in the game that there will be issues if you stay there. And I found this contrary to what they were saying earlier when they said there would be absolutely no more save wipes or loss of data after the Faithful Cartographer launch. And that update was only a couple months ago in the summer.
Maybe I don't have a firm understanding here, but being in that location would wipe your data. How does that actually happen, though? Does the game basically just base it on your XYZ coordinates?
I think they're suggesting that there may be some glitches that could be involved, and they don't know whether that will actually kill your data or not. Because if you're in a structure that they're going to update and change, and say your file is in the structure that is then getting wiped and replaced, for instance, maybe your data doesn't transfer appropriately and you have corruption of a file or something. They were unclear on what would actually happen, but they said, you know, it's a general warning that you should go ahead and evacuate the area for this update.
I feel like there are two solutions that they could have, or one solution that may not have made people happy, but could have avoided that problem entirely, and that's to basically just reset anyone to a different location.
Yeah, move you to just a different spawn point. Or if they're updating internal structures in Mystery Lake, for instance, and some of the just external structures, if they can just have your character go to a generalized spawn point. Like, there's a cabin that's kind of in the middle of the area. I mean, it's at the lower end, but it's pretty central as far as the edges of the map are concerned. And they could just spawn you right outside of that cabin. And that would be, I think, a totally fair move.
Yeah, I'm surprised they haven't issued after the... I'm assuming there's some backlash to this. If people are mad about moose, then I imagine they could be a bit upset about potentially losing their files because there is not a definitive definition of where is safe and where is not safe.
Right. Just outside of the area is safe. But if you've stockpiled in one of those areas or you've set up like a main base, unless you got a lot of time to play the game, it might not be very easy to move your stuff out in time. So you're probably going to lose it. I've already given up on one character. And so like I feel bad about it, but not completely, because I'll probably play the story mode when it releases and I'll do the sandbox again. But yeah, it is. It's a little annoying, at least. If I had a character that was like hundreds of days in the game and my main base was in Mystery Lake, I'd kind of be a little pissed.
So are the story modes going to be fully developed for this official release?
At least chapter 1 and 2 will be completely ready to play. And more will be on the way.
One's been out for a while, right?
No. They're releasing 1 and 2 at the same time.
Okay.
Yeah, so it'll be, you'll play as one character for chapter 1 and one character for chapter 2. And that is about all the information they've given, concrete.
Assumedly, one's going to be the guy and one's going to be the girl?
That's right. I'm trying to think. It's Will McKenzie, the bush pilot, and I forget the girl's name, but I believe she's a doctor or an ecologist, or she's some sort of doctor and or scientist. And so each one of them, I don't know if they'll have related stories, I imagine so, or if they'll have disjointed stories and it'll come together later in the game.
Is there a lot of information on the male character?
Will McKenzie, bush pilot, likes to complain about being cold a lot. I don't know much past that, though, really.
Wait, I thought he was the guy that didn't talk about his problems, so...
Well, the girl talks about the problems a lot more frequently, but I just find the guy whinier for some reason. Yeah, he speaks less, but he's more annoying when he talks, so maybe it's a benefit.
And he's selectively annoying.
Yeah, unfortunately, he chooses his words carefully, and he makes sure to select words that bother me as the person controlling him.
It's like, oh, my hands are moist. They're so cold and moist.
Oh, that's gross.
I don't really care about my broken ankles. Those are fine, but my hands, oh gosh.
I wish I had mittens.
Does he actually say that?
No. He would, but I always make sure I have... he might. I'm just saying I always make sure he has mittens on, because otherwise you're freezing. And that's everything I've got for the sandbox and story mode release. I'll have a lot more, of course, when August 1st comes and goes and I've played a little bit more. But to keep the hype going, I've chosen for our outro track the track that they used for the Long Dark launch teaser trailer, which is Agnes Opal's The Curse. It's a little haunting, and it should get people who have seen the release trailer excited or interest them in watching it, because it's a really good song.
And before we cap off, if you have questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach us at podcast@fancyramen.com or make a comment below if you're viewing on YouTube. In addition to that, if you're enjoying the show, we'd love it if you could review our podcast on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, and tell a friend. So that does it for episode 26 of the Fancy Ramen Podcast. I believe the title of this is going to be In Which Cookie Does Not Make an Appearance, or something like that.
I like that. That's a good option.
I'm Neil.
And I'm Scott. See you later.